Welcome, everyone, to Filmstrips, the podcast about two souls whose intentions are good. Please don't let us be misunderstood. I'm Dave.
And I'm Andrew Kanigeiser, and I never thought I would feel this way, but I've got to say that I just can't get it right. How are you tonight, Dave?
I'm doing pretty good. I mean, we had such a really good episode last time, a very fruitful discussion, you know, about wholesomeness and cleanliness and, you know, the good and decent nature of mankind. I feel like we need to get away from that now for a bit. How about you?
Yeah, I'm feeling well, despite being absolutely buried underneath coursework. But, I mean, that's becoming my my go-to introduction line for myself. And yeah, I'm also happy to be celebrating first anniversary with my partner tonight. So naturally, I'm celebrating by sequestering myself in the bedroom, recording a podcast over Skype about a movie that maybe not a hidden gem, but certainly hidden, I think, in terms of popular awareness. What are we looking at this week, David?
Okay, so last week we took a look at Superman the movie, which is part of its cast featured one, Valerie Perrine. And she leads us here to 20 years later to the 1998 film 54. Mark Christopher's fiction film that inspired by and set amongst the notorious Studio 54 from the 1970s, the wonderful disco club in which, you know, common people and celebrities could meet and co-mingle and exist together, or at least that's the popular image of it. And we'll get a bit more into that in a little bit.
It's like New York City's answer to the Viper Room.
Yeah. So I gotta say, Andrew, I know where my answer lies with this, but this is a film that came out when, you know, I was at the time, let's see if I'm getting my math correct. Either 13 or 14, depending upon the day when it came out. But, you know, this was a film that was coming out at the time. And for an odd amount, I have really distinct memories of this thing being a major hyped release upon back in 98.
I would have been 12 years old, and I remember this film being everywhere. I mean, back in the days when Much Music wasn't all just episodes of The Hills and things like that, I remember there was a lot of marketing behind this, at least in more teen outlets. I mean, I remember also being in the bathroom and, like, flipping through my sister's copy of 16 magazine, and, like, they were even previewing it there. And, yeah, I remember a couple things about the marketing. We kept getting the shot of Ryan Phillippe taking his shirt off. I guess that yes. was our generation's John Wayne moment. The shirt lift that made him a star. I remember everyone being like, oh, is the world ready for Mike Myers doing drama? And I also remember everywhere you went that summer, the song If You Could Read My Mind by Stars on 54 was everywhere.
Yeah, it was, that's pretty much it. Although I mostly found out about through magazines such as Entertainment Weekly and that. I didn't have much music at that point in time. But it was, yeah, no, that thing really seemed to hype up. And I distinctly remember all the hype leading up to it, all the controversy surrounding it, because this is a film with a bit of a tortured production. Again, we'll get there eventually. That was somehow publicly noted. And after all the hype, after all the build-up, this thing came and went like nobody's business, and I never ended up actually seeing it until now for this podcast.
I remember being curious, and my older brother was actually really excited to go see it, and I think he went on opening night, and then he got home, and I'm like, how was it? He was, like, palpably angry with how much he disliked the film. I mean, usually when I always find it's kind of a tell when everyone can't stop talking about a certain property up until the moment that it's released. And if everyone suddenly stops talking about it then, that tells you something. Look at Anchorman 2. Look at whenever there's a new season of Arrested Development. I mean, it's like it's great that everybody's excited, but if they all clam up, it's basically whatever happens every time I try and release an album on SoundCloud. But it lets you know that something decidedly went wrong in the execution.
Yeah, and while I will defend Anchorman 2, but that's a discussion for another day. Yeah, no, this was a film that, you know, sort of came and went. And then a couple of years ago, back in 2015, the film suddenly found new life on home video again when the director's cut, the long-rumored, long-missing version of this movie, was finally released on Blu-ray after being screened at a couple festivals a few years prior, at least from a VHS bootleg of that director Mark Christopher still had of his original cut
it's
of this.
A real labor thing. Of love, and I guess. It's Mark Christopher's Chimes at Midnight.
Well, to be honest, as we get into this, you're not necessarily all that wrong. This is definitely a film that was a labor of love for him, but we'll get there in a few minutes. I think it's a good thing to back up for a minute and sort of discuss why this film is at least worth taking a look at.
Yeah, here. Because having seen the film, David, I'm very curious to hear you explain that.
Well, there were sort of three key things that this film brings together, besides my own morbid curiosity to finally see the film that everybody was sort of talking about in 1998 and then wasn't. And the first thing is that this film, 54, is very much a product of the 90s era in quote-unquote indie film, in which, you know, indie cinema went from being what the name implies, which is independently financed films outside of the studio system, usually, which, you know, typically meant lower budgets in more controversial subject matter, which had been sort of gradually absorbed into the Hollywood system itself. Basically, as throughout the 1980s, as independent distributors sort of ceased to exist and were going out of style or being bought up by the major companies, most notably, for our purposes here, a little company called Miramax, run by the notorious, long before last year even, Weinstein
Brothers. Well, I think also, what kind of helps give rise to the squeeze out of the independent distributors, you know, what is it, Samuel Arkoff and people like that, Roger Corman, guys who, pretty much straight to drive-in filmmaking, but if you wanted to get a movie made and you could pull together $40,000, these guys would help you do it. But through the 1980s, especially, like we've talked about the Paramount decision and the breakup of the studios, what ends up happening in the 80s is that all of a sudden studios themselves are being bought out by larger corporations and media conglomerates. So all of a sudden, it's still Paramount Studios, but all of a sudden they have a tremendous amount of financial weight behind them. So they become powerful again in a way that doesn't violate monopoly laws.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is the period in which Coca-Cola buys up Columbia. This is also the period in which originally Time ends up buying Warner Brothers, becoming Time Warner, which hence that great 70s era logo, the red and white one that occasionally showed up before films. That thing was still my favorite Warner's logo out of all of them. But you had that happening, and eventually you get things like MCA Universal and so on and so forth. But yeah, so as they become, you know, everything sort of coalesces and, you know, everything sort of moves to the center and basically you see the distribution arena sort of dry up in terms of where you can get your film seen. What gradually happens in the late 80s into the 90s is we start seeing a sort of merger between Hollywood and what we consider independent films. And this is telling where the trade-off seems to be. These are films where the content is, quote-unquote, the sort of things that you would see independent films do, which is edgier or more touchy subject matter or things that wouldn't get done in a mainstream Hollywood film, but suddenly with enough money in that behind it that you could get, you know, Hollywood stars working at a discount to appear in these films. And in many cases, this became paved the way for more of the Oscar bait films as we would come to know them in the 90s. And certainly without this sort of maneuver, you wouldn't end up with films like, say, Pulp Fiction, which is, you know, sort of, again, coming back to Miramax, a film which content-wise really doesn't align itself with traditional Hollywood material, and certainly not in terms of its storytelling. But lo and behold, you have Bruce Willis in the film. You have a John Travolta and Uma Thurman, who are doing this. And it becomes a way in which, you know, stars and actors are able to supposedly have some sort of, you know, street credit, I guess is the best way to put it.
And I think especially because so many of the indie filmmakers that went Hollywood, they, like, it's almost impossible to overstate the importance of the Sundance Film Festival. Out of sort of like that early 90s, I guess, cohort, Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino are probably the most successful cases. But yeah, like that, you know, all it takes is them making films that end up being picked up, especially, and as much as I hate to give credit to them, the Weinstein brothers really help bring about that idea of, you know, that there's something chic about festival filmmaking in America. And you're right. I mean, A-listers suddenly turn down bigger projects that would have paid them more because there's a certain cultural cachet to be had in making a smaller, more personal, potentially more transgressive film for a much more limited audience. But in a roundabout way, that ends up being sold to the major distributors and given worldwide distribution anyway.
One, this is the thing. I mean, basically every studio ends up setting up their own quote-unquote independent wing, where you have things like Fox Searchlight, which is for all the quote-unquote Fox indie projects that they're going to be making. And on one hand, there's plenty of great movies that come out of this phase. I mean, certainly, as much as I think the 90s deserves more criticism than it necessarily gets, I kind of understand why there is a segment that looks at the 90s as the new 70s, because there was, at least as far as Hollywood cinema going, more experimentation and more variety being offered at that point in time. At the same time, and what ultimately I think as we get into 54 itself starts to become clear, there is a very fine tension that exists in doing this. Because, again, when you're making an independent film like Ganja and Hess, or, you know, Night of the Living Dead, or any number of other noteworthy films, you know, when you're doing it independently and you've basically raised the capital on your own and you're doing it without a studio overlords looking over your shoulder, you can get away with a heck of a lot more and you can go much farther than you can.
That's the archetype of the auteur that is assumed under auteur theory. Like, that's the closest approximation. Like, generally, you have the one individual responsible for everything, even including the performances in some cases. Everything they do is strictly on their own terms, and so the finished film really is, like, made by the individual.
Yeah, but when you start looking at these 90s films, what becomes controversial is when you start getting into films with, you know, subject matter that is very much not the mainstream, but you're still spending, you know, things like $10 million, $12 million, budgets that are paltry compared to most modest budgeted to high budgeted Hollywood films, but that's still a lot of money. And yeah, as much as places like Miramax would like to present themselves as champions of indie cinema, they are still, you know, they want to make back their investment and then some, which leads to this tension between suddenly, you know, yeah, you get the big stars and you get the, you know, glossier production values and you can afford to have the soundtrack that you wanted for your movie, but you may end up having to make a heck of a lot of compromises in order to get there. And sometimes, even after you've agreed to what the film is supposedly going to be, as is the case in the of 54. Again, we'll get there in a second. So that's kind of reason one for why to look at this. Number two, this is also something that basically is a bit about Hollywood myth-making. Because the thing about Studio 54 itself, and I'm not going to present myself by any stretch of the imagination as being an expert on the real place and its real history.
Wow, so we found one subject that Dave isn't an expert on.
I'm far from an expert, but I can say research took me down some weird roads. You haven't lived until you've watched Disco Sally being interviewed on a show alongside Lawrence Welk.
Wow. That sounds so much more interesting than this movie.
But at any rate, the thing about it is, you know, Studio 54 is notorious as being the place where stars and celebrities hung out, and it was the place to be, and all sorts of wild and crazy stories took place there. And again, you would think something like that, you know, obviously given Hollywood's sort of self-love, it's kind of natural that this is a film that would come to exist. Except the thing about Studio 54, and again, this is very much going to be what we're talking about as we get into the film proper, there is a tension there, because on one hand, you know, there's all these legendary tales and deeds that apparently went on over at the studio involving some of the major stars of the era. And again, if you watch the theatrical cut of this movie, as the end credits play, you're going to see real footage from the era of guys like Sly Stallone and others popping up, coming to the studio and getting through the front doors into this thing. But again, Studio 54 was basically a place known for its debauchery as well.
Yeah, if and the 70s club circuit was known as a period of high excess, Studio 54 is like the excess within that. It the word hedonistic seems to be appropriate based on the legends that everybody who talked about living through that decade do. I mean, it's like Woodstock, where it's almost like you have to take everything with a grain of salt because it sounds too crazy to be real. And the old adage, well, if you can remember being there, you weren't there, man.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, there is enough photographic evidence to suggest that a lot of the debauchery did happen. But, I mean, it certainly puts this film in a weird position where, you know, we're talking in many cases, certainly as far as 1998 was concerned, this was an instance where many of the people who attended Studio 54 were still alive. And on top of which, maybe didn't necessarily want all those tales coming out, particularly in a fictional, in the form of a film. So we have a film that, you know, really, that is ultimately Hollywood talking about its own past. And as we will see, as we discuss the film, there is a struggle there with what to do with it, which is particularly noteworthy in light, again, of all the revelations as to just how scumbaggish the Weinstein brothers themselves are. Because it's hard not to look at this movie and not and even as much as Mark Christopher and them, you know, may have kept them at a distance, they were there. They funded this movie. And when you consider the plot line of this film, at least in its director's cut version particularly, oh boy, does this open up all sorts of, you know, uncomfortable scenarios to start talking about. But last but certainly not least, the third reason is, you know, one thing we haven't talked about on the show yet, Andrew, which sort of dovetails with the indie cinema component, is new queer cinema. Basically, a period starting, I believe, if my history is correct, it's sort of considered to begin in the mid to late 80s.
I think that's generally agreed upon. I mean, it's not a terribly rigid category. I mean, it's more like, as opposed to like a concerted effort by a collective, you know, it's not like Dogma 95, where a group of filmmakers like made a manifesto and said, we now are the new queer cinema. But rather in the 90s, late 80s, you see home video markets suddenly expand. Distribution becomes a lot easier. Independent cinema does become a bit more viable. And as a result, like changing social attitudes means like, for instance, Midnight Cowboy. That is a film that deals with issues pertaining to queerness. It was also given an X rating when it came out, not for anything necessarily explicit, but on content lines. The idea that America's not ready to hear stories of queerness. Whereas in the 80s into the 90s, you have people like Derek Jarman, you have people like Todd Haynes, that they are finally able to get that foothold in cinema and not just work in the industry, but start telling stories for something other than this imaginary nuclear family that goes to the movies every Friday.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly there's any number of noteworthy films from this period which sort of deal with this. But I, again, coming back to sort of memories of my youth, it was very notable how controversial many of these films were, particularly when it started coming to films that were either being distributed or made by major studio outlets. Again, another film which I believe was not distributed by Miramax, if I'm not mistaken, Priest from 1994.
I think that was Touchstone, because I remember a lot of the backlash, because Touchstone was owned by Disney, right? So yes, everyone was up in arms saying, oh, well, the studio that gave us Snow White is teaching kids that it's okay to not be like everybody else. This will not stand.
Well, it's the thing. And I mean, looking at the company credits, you know, apparently it was Miramax and Polygram. But again, it doesn't change it because Miramax also is owned by that point in time, I believe, Disney as well. Because they buy them around 90. I want to say it's around 94, 95 is when they are bought by Disney.
Okay. But that further reinforces the idea of what is independent filmmaking.
Well, exactly, and that's just it. But yeah, no, you had films like Priest, which, you know, were shockingly, you know, people got really riled up about that one. Certainly My Own Private Idaho, you know, courted controversy with its young stars and up-and-coming director Gus Van Sant at the time. And certainly, you know, again, not to... Even in mainstream culture, you would have things like, again, not to talk about this show too much, but Friends in its early run, doing things such as featuring a gay wedding, as they refer to it.
Yeah, that was so brave of them.
Ross's ex-wife. Ugh. Yeah, and that's just it. I mean, what was considered brave versus taboo and shocking? You know, it's weird looking back on it now thinking, oh, some of the stuff that was quote-unquote shocking is so utterly quaint.
Yeah, Ellen DeGeneres getting fired for kissing somebody on TV. And then you stop and you realize that was, like, only 20 years ago. And it seems like a lifetime in terms of social attitudes.
Yeah, but then that's just it. So, of course, you have a, you know, this brings us to Mark Christopher. And Mark Christopher, who is the writer-director behind 54. Now, the thing about it is, and I guess we're pretty much going to be getting into the production history of the film and the film proper itself at this point. Not to make a long story much, much, much shorter. as it was fun trying to do with these
films. Okay deferring discussion of this film as long as we can.
Fair. Fine. At any rate, the short version is this. Mark Christopher was a young and up-and-coming filmmaker throughout the late 80s, early 90s. Working, again, I believe he was in university at the time, but he made several shorts dealing with openly queer themes, including The Dead Boys Club, which gained quite a bit of traction, which is available online for people to watch. There, it's actually not a bad little short. Again, you know, there's some technical rough around the edgesness that's not unexpected from what is more or less a student film.
Yeah, a student using a rented handycam, Dave. Give the guy some credit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very well done. And he started gaining traction, and one of the things he was approached by was a executive at Miramax basically asking whether he would consider becoming involved with doing a project on Studio 54. Now, that individual was Jonathan King, who I don't believe works with the studio anymore, but he basically got Christopher involved, and for 5 years, Christopher was researching and putting together the script for what would ultimately become 54. The film ended up, you know, everybody agreed to what the film was going to be. They went through a fairly long casting process to lock down all the major players that they wanted in this film. And everybody agreed what the movie was going to be. And lo and behold, again, Mark Christopher very explicitly made it up front that this was going to be a film about a, as he phrases it, a bisexual love triangle between individual and a married couple.
Yeah, and I feel like that makes sense, because a big part of the appeal of 70s club circuit, especially in cosmopolitan regions like New York, it's very difficult to sort of separate queerness out of it. Like, one of my personal favorite films, Todd Haynes' Velvet Goldmine, it's almost comparable, like, what, tipping my hand a bit about what ends up happening with this film, but, like, that's a film about glam rock culture, especially in England in the 1970s, and it's very difficult to talk about that without bringing up themes of queerness, because these are periods very much linked with that concept and with that realization of sort of non-traditional social identities, as many people would describe them at the time. So far, so good, right, Dave?
Absolutely. And they go off and, you know, on, from what I can see online, is listed as a $12 million budget. They go up to Toronto and end up shooting this movie. Once they've done that, they come back, they edit it together, and everybody at the studio seems really, really excited to show or buy this film. Internally, everything's going A-okay, and then they test screen it. And suddenly, from by all accounts, was not necessarily the intended audience for this film. And it doesn't, again, according to Mark Christopher himself, one of the big things that happens at the time is that the cast that they had selected for this movie, which includes Ryan Phillippe, Selma Hayek, Mike Myers, and Breckin Meyer, and one Neve Campbell, and we'll get to her later on, ended up becoming bigger actors who were on the cusp of becoming superstars. So suddenly this film had a lot higher expectations going on for it. And when the test audiences kind of rejected elements such as the fact that this was a film about an openly bisexual individual, and, you know, the fact that most of the characters are, to some extent, fairly unlikable, and that how scummy much of 54's premise is, the ever-loving studio demanded rewrites and reshoots ended up happening, resulting in a film released in 1998 that Mark Christopher was not happy with, and nor did critics, and nor did audiences, and nor did just about anybody.
Yeah, not even the studio, because did this even recoup its budget in terms of box office?
Not from the looks of it at all, and on top of which, I mean, this film, when this film came out, it was around 90-something odd minutes, and they only restored like an additional 8 or 10 minutes on home video. Still not the way Mark Christopher wanted it. It wasn't like they suddenly, well, here's this cut for anybody else.
Because I watched the home video cut, and it ran about hour 35, hour 40. So the director's cut, how much additional footage is in the film then?
Well, let's put it this way. Having watched the two cuts of this film, there is around, as listed, about 40 minutes worth of difference.
40 it's not simply minutes. That 40. Is half of the theatrical running time, just about.
Yeah, because this film, it's not simply a matter of that scenes were deleted from this version. No. Entire sections of this movie were completely rewritten and reshot and changed and altered. And the further the film goes on, watching the two cuts back to back, man, do those differences add up in some fairly substantial ways. But having said that, I think it's probably good to give a overall plot summary as best we can at this point for our listeners. Keep in mind, folks, spoilers ahead. So if you are dying to see 54 in any version, just know we're really going to get into this in a going forward. So, Andrew, what would you say, since you watched the theatrical cut for this release, how about you give us the quick and dirty plot description of what this
film
is about?
Okay, I like where this is going. So overall, the film is the story of Shayna O'Shea, who is, you know, the young sort of small town boy, living somewhere in New York anyway, who won New Jersey. Hackensack, perhaps?
Yeah. I might actually
it
be.
It may have been. What is it with Valerie Perrine in New Jersey? So, yes, one night, him and his buddies, they want to go clubbing, so they drive into Manhattan, and they're standing in line at Studio 54, and that's when we get the shirt lift-off scene, where they say, your buddies can't come in, but you can, only if you lose the shirt. And all of a sudden, walking through those doors, Shay walks into a brave new world of liberation and hedonism, or at least that's what the narration tells us. He befriends two people that work there, Greg and Anita, and at the same time, he's given a job by Steve Rubell, the charismatic and mercurial and horrible human being that owns the place. And then he eventually sort of rises up in the club circuit world, starts rubbing shoulders with celebrities, and then he realizes that nobody has integrity, and that's really the thing that matters. So he ends up, in a roundabout way, it all comes to a head on New Year's Eve, where everything that can go wrong happens at the exact same time, and everyone goes their separate ways. Steve goes to prison, but on his release, he has one night where he gets everyone back together and they celebrate and dance and remember the good old times that they had in a magic place called Studio 54. Cue that song. That's basically the story. And in some respects, like, there's some familiar tropes, and familiar tropes with new queer cinema as well. But in a very refracted sense, I mean, we have things like the family conflict, moving out, discovering who you really are, sort of the ingratiation within, like, the bohemian circuit, and things like that. Only we see the actions and we see the plot beats, but in the theatrical cut, the issue of queerness is bracketed off almost completely. So it ends up feeling like a cover version of a much more impactful film.
Yeah, and this is the thing. The general plot description you've given, Andrew, at least as far as the setup goes, is the same with the director's cut. Shane O'Shea, this young man who dreams of getting out of New Jersey, you know, and making it, you know, in the world of New York City where, you know, he can be somebody, you know, does get into Studio 54 at night, again, with the famed shirt removal scene there after Steve Rubell, you know, says, you know, you can get in, just not in that shirt. And he, yeah, he gets a job as first as a busboy and ends up ingratiating himself into the lives of Greg and Anita, eventually being offered a place to come live with them, which becomes particularly important as we sort of discover in Shane's home life. His father seems to at least implicitly be homophobic and is certainly explicitly bigoted when it comes to the issue of race.
Yeah, and that is not at all present in the theatrical cut. Again, like, it defangs the narrative in a sense, where, because in the theatrical cut, all we're given is, he comes home the next morning, it's like, so, I went to Studio 54 with my friends, and, like, dad crushes the glass in his hands, and it's like, you did what? No son of mine! And it's like, so, he is moving out because his father's intolerant because he doesn't like nightclubs? And, like, his dad literally just disappears from the film after that.
Well, and it's the thing, and it's not like there's much more with the father in the director's cut, but there's enough there that it changes the whole context of what Shane is walking away from in the film. And, you know, the sort of struggle he has, you know, with leaving, because, yeah, he has sisters as well that he's
played
sort of
by Heather Matizero.
Yeah, is the slightly older sister that, you know, of the duo. And yeah, it really starts shifting things. But what also ends up happening, as ostensibly both versions follow Shane as he quickly comes to realize how to sort of survive and thrive in the environment of Studio 54, which basically means you're on the hustle and selling yourself, pretty much. I mean, not explicitly as, you know, prostitution in the sense of, you know, that is exactly what his job is, but that's pretty much what he's doing in order to make his way in the world. The key difference being, however, that in the case of the theatrical cut, it's all pretty much with women throughout the film.
Yeah, and, he basically has two romantic couplings. There's his flirtation slash affair with Anita, and then there's his relationship with Julie, played by Neve Campbell, who's the small town girl done good.
You're also forgetting his relationship with Billy, the music producer slash Steve Rubell's friend, played by Selma Ward.
Oh, yeah! Who also disappears from the film midway through. It's like reading a Goosebumps book.
Yeah, she does reappear in the director's cut a fair bit more. But yeah, basically she ends up sort of initiating Shane into the world of which he's becoming involved with. And in the case of, yeah, the theatrical version, that's what's going on. And what we end up seeing is, as sort of Shane makes his way up the ladder, he ends up becoming a bartender, which are basically treated like, you know, the major players at Studio 54 and what everybody wants to get, in which Greg has been aiming to try and make himself. The end result in the theatrical cut is Greg sort of distraught at the fact that he once in the film doesn't get the barman position, ends up deciding to take up selling drugs and does so by initially stealing some of the money that Steve Rubell is skimming off of, you know, from the profits and is hiding up in his ceiling. there and using that to sort of buy his way in, start selling drugs. And from that point forward, you know, the film sort of becomes the fact that, you know, Anita is caught between her husband, the schemer played by Breckenmeyer, who's trying to make his way up in the world, and is willing to seemingly do whatever it takes to get there. Anita and, you know, Shane, who also
a
is
a schemer trying to make his way up in the world.
Up in the world. And which is a kind of befitting given that she's also a schemer.
Trying to make her way up in the world.
The world. And in her instance, it's through music. And oh boy, is that dynamic totally different in the director's cut. Because basically what the theatrical version does is it basically splinters the worst aspects of Shane, the, you know, his sort of scheming and, you know, money hungriness and everything about him, and shifts it onto Greg for the most part. So yeah, in the director's cut version, Greg is still distraught about not getting the barman's position, but it's mainly because he just wants to make enough money that him and Anita can live and have a decent life. And you know, he ends up selling drugs, but mostly, as he views it, the sort of harmless stuff. And out of a moment of, you know, Shane, who's blowing his money like nobody's business and getting into trouble, ends up agreeing to help Shane get in on the business of selling drugs himself, which leads to Shane stealing the money out of Steve Rebell's, you know, skimmed funds that are up in his office roof. And the whole film from there ends up following sort of Shane as he's caught romantically attracted to both Anita and to Greg himself. Meanwhile, Shane is also basically sleeping with anybody and everybody, both man and women, in order to make his way up the chain of things. And it's very, I will say this, it's fascinating watching the theatrical cut and director's cut to see how footage is repurposed and, you know, recontextualized between the two cuts. Because remember the shot in the film of Greg in the hot tub receiving, or at least implied to be receiving, a favor of some sort?
Yes.
Well, what they kind of sort of skip over is the fact that the hot tub he's in is with the first man he sleeps with. And that what's going on is that when that man moves from Greg and whispers into the ear of that woman to come over and do something for him. So again, and not to mention, there's the montage of who does Shane sleep with over the course of the film. And yeah, there are some explicit shots of him waking up beside men that were completely removed
from the theatrical cut as well. This is one of the problems I have with the film. Because, all right.
Yeah.
Let's just set aside the fact that, all right, you knew exactly who Mark Christopher was, exactly what he built his reputation doing, like the thematic territory that his work is concerned with, and the story that he wants to tell. Everyone approves it right up until the moment that it's made, and then they panic and say, oh no, we can't have a film that's too quote-unquote gay for the masses. This won't play in Peoria. So they end up recutting it. The theatrical cut then becomes this hodgepodge of, like, patchwork footage. You described it as a Frankenstein's monster of a film, and I would only disagree because Dr. Frankenstein, at least, he went to med school, so he had some idea what he was doing. The problem is that it creates this really weird effect, though, because all the footage, bodies are codified, especially male bodies in this film, as the subject of the gaze, G-A-Z-E, but, like, especially, like, the bartenders and the bar stalkers, like, they're wearing Daisy Dukes, and no one has a shred of body hair or anything. Like, they're there to be looked at. And, like, every glance between Ryan Philippe and Breckenmeyer is a loaded gesture. Even Steve Rubell, even though, like, he's presented as sort of detached from it, almost like a bored god just stirring up trouble amongst his subjects to see what happens. Like, there's still, like, an incredible amount of homoeroticism on display. And they can't get rid of that without making, like, the film over from scratch. So instead they end up recutting it in a way that all it does is strip the text of any meaning or any impact that these images might have had. And it is the most bizarre experience.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. Because this, what the basically ends up happening with the studio theatrical release version is it's an after-school special with sex and drugs, is what it really
Yeah, it
comes
comes
down
off
to.
as very moralizing. And considering that by cutting footage of, Shane's father, like doubling down on homophobia and racist language and transphobia to an extent, all it is like, oh, well, he doesn't like it because he's too pat and moralistic. He thinks that this is just sinful in a general catch-all sense. But that ends up kind of being the same attitude that the theatrical cut of the film ends up embracing by the end. But only,
Well, it.
yes,
No,
okay, let
sorry.
me qualify.
No, no, sorry.
There's that one tendency in the film. Ultimately, the film is so fractured that it doesn't even seem to understand what it is, what Studio 54 is even supposed to represent. Like, it ends up being so inconsistent in what kind of story it's trying to tell that it's impossible to keep up with.
Well, and this is the thing. You're hitting right upon where I was looking to go, because let's put aside the difference in the two cuts of this movie for just one second here. And, one way or the other, the initial intention of this movie is basically to look at, what is Studio 54 in the eyes of its filmmakers? And, by, association, what does it think of Steve Rubell? And it's very notable, we should note here that it's Steve Rubell is the only one who's brought up as the owner and operator of Studio 54 in this film. They certainly don't bring up individuals like Ian Schrager, who was Rubell's partner and co-ran Studio 54, and is notably still alive, at least at the time we're recording this. Watch him die tomorrow. And this will be completely out of context, but certainly at any rate, he was alive during the making of this film. And I think this gets into kind of part of the problem is how do you make a film about Studio 54 when legally almost 90% of what you would want to talk about you can't talk about in this movie, because nobody's going to admit or go on record or allow you without getting sued like nobody's business, number one. But two, putting it back again, the thing about it is, what the film is aiming to, and I will give Mark Christopher this. He doesn't succeed in either cut necessarily. He succeeds more in his own director's cut, but it still doesn't work. It's the idea that, the outside world, or the world outside of Studio 54, is so rotten in a sense that this club is a place in which people, there is a freedom of identity and expression that could go on there. So much in that freedom of expression is so important that, yeah, for a lot of people, they were willing to overlook, the fact that this was also a very predatory environment.
Incredibly
And
so. But, okay, sorry. I will let you go. I will
yeah.
swallow my vitriol for now.
Sorry, no, you're gonna like this where it's going, because that's the thing. In the director's cut of the film, it's more open about the fact that, yeah, this is a predatory environment, and that Steve Rubell is very much this sort of monster in the way in which he operates, because he Marcus sort of describes him as a tragic figure. But from what we see in the film, Rubell very explicitly manipulates and takes advantage of people, and sometimes does it just for his own amusement over the course of the film. Like, I mean, one of the big plot points is in both versions of the film, there is a moment in which Shane sleeps with Anita in the bath one of the
Well, they don't
bathrooms of
sleep.
54.
They don't even sit down.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. They have sex in a bathroom stall in 54, and in a very creepy moment, you see Mike Myers, Steve Rubell start staring through the stall and looking at them. This sets up a plot point that does not happen in the theatrical cut, but which does happen in the director's cut, where Rubell, repeats a request he made of Greg earlier in the film when they're alone again, and Greg seems ready to go with it. And then this leads to a whole conversation where Rubell, just seemingly for the giggles, points out that, he already watched Shane and Anita at it early in the film, which sets Greg off in a moment of fury at both his wife and, quote unquote, his best friend,
Yeah.
as it
See,
were.
because in the theatrical cut, there is that shot, and I think it's probably the most interesting shot in the entire movie, only because it opens a lot of possibilities and none of them are good, but at least it's interesting. But yeah, like it just doesn't happen after that. So the end result is like it doesn't give us a lens to read Steve as a character. If anything, it's one more thing he does that we never get any insight. So with the theatrical cut, like scenes like this and like the lack of fleshing him out in any meaningful way, like he is an enigma at best. Like we're given a voiceover narration when we're first introduced. But all it does is talk about here's where he used to work. Here's when he opened up the club. Here's what he wants the club to be. And we're never given insight, except even at the very end, it's like, spoiler alert, the IRS is coming in and they're coming to take him away. And Shane warns him and tells him to run. And Steve just says, like, resignedly, where else would I go? But that's not enough to make him a tragic figure. We just know that he enjoys winding people up, setting them off on one another, and we're never given a reason why. We just see him do all these terrible things, and yet the film ends with this ludicrous coda where we're supposed to see him as, well, he's the guy that made all our dreams come true.
Well, this is the thing about the theatrical cut because, again, I will give Mark Christopher credit. I don't think he's entirely successful with the director's cut, but because you don't have that narration and so much of, the additions of the director or theatrical cut are missing, you're at least left to make up your mind on Steve Rubell for the most part and sort of, draw your own conclusions from his actions. The theatrical cut explicitly opens the film up almost painting him like he's a Willy Wonka-esque figure. And that, he was the dreamer who put together this crazy club where, everybody could co-meet and mingle and all these things. And then you come back to the end of the movie, and despite all the horrifying things we've seen Steve Rubell do over the course of the film, you have that coda where, again, he just everybody sort of pities him, and it's like, man, the magic was gone, but it's a good thing he had that one last night. Like, they can't make up their
Well,
mind
yeah. And
as
like,
to
maybe it's also
who's.
because the narration was delivered by Ryan Philippe, who, I mean, speaking of Weinstein territory, but that, like, even prior to that, I have never been a fan of Ryan Philippe as an actor. He only seems to have one mode, and it's never appropriate for the characters that he's cast as. But here, like, him, like, telling. His narration bothered me so much about this film. I think I would like the director's cut better just by virtue of the fact it's not there. But at the end, like, he's talking about Steve, but he's also mentioning, like, well, when Steve got back from prison, he decided to have one last big party, and he only invited all of his friends. First off, there's like 500 people in the club, so that's a lot of friends. Hard to feel bad for this guy. I have like three, and I'm talking to one of them right now. But also, like, where's the friendship? All the relationships in this film, especially the theatrical cut, whether it's between Steve and everyone, even between Shane and everyone, all the relationships in this film are transactional. People are just killing time with one another on their way of getting something more out of it down the line. So there's never that sense of camaraderie. There's never a sense of kinship beyond the fact that we are told by the film in one of the last things it does is, well, don't worry, everyone was really good friends and we all cared about each other a lot. And that is completely negated by everything we've seen in the previous 90 minutes.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think it's interesting because one of the big changes, again, for the director's cut is one of the plot points is in both versions is that Steve Rubell fires his accountant who is openly helping him hiding the money throughout the film or early on in the film. And she can't understand why. And it's basically because of that money that in the theatrical cut, Greg stole and he can't put his pieces together or can't put the pieces together. Leading him to, as it's presented in the theatrical cut, fire her out of paranoia that she's stealing things, which leaves her, who seems to be the only friend Steve actually has, to angrily leave. In the director's cut, Steve pieces it together pretty quickly that Shane is the one who stole the money. And he basically, in the same scene, but with additional footage, he does fire his accountant, but he basically says, it's like, I need to offer somebody's head has to roll you know, he's an asset on the floor.
Okay, that there. Was in You're my not. Version, so that may be in the home video cut, but not the theatrical one.
Well, it's the scene is in both versions, but there's additional dialogue where he basically explains. It's like, I know Shane did it, but I'm still firing you anyway. And that comes back to bite him later on, because when the IRS agents raid the office, because the IRS stuff is completely different in both versions, because in the theatrical cut, there's all these little cutaways to the IRS talking to people, or at least the federal agents. I shouldn't call them the IRS, but these anonymous federal agents who watch the Steve Rubell TV interview and seem to get so angry at it. It's like, well, we've got to investigate.
Well, because he's going on TV and, you know, the famous trailer quote is, well, what the IRS doesn't know can't hurt them. It's like, how much sympathy do we feel for a guy who's not only a predatory jerk, but also has no problem going on TV and effectively confessing to money laundering?
Well, that's the thing about it, is that, I mean, that is similar to what happened, supposedly, in real life. Rubell did give an interview, although I think it was a newspaper one as opposed to a TV one, that led to the IRS and other federal agencies investigating him. But the thing about it is, in the director's cut, you never cut away to the IRS. They only show up at the end, and when you see them raiding the office at the end, the accountant is with them, which was deleted from the theatrical version for who knows what, because it doesn't make sense. I mean, of course she would turn on him. Of course she would be the one pointing out where everything is.
But I thought they were such good friends. It's okay. Well, let me ask you this, though, David. Yeah. It sounds like the director's cut is a more cohesive and coherent film. And they're, you know, with 40 minutes of different footage. And, like, as you said, it's not even just, like, the order of scenes or adding and subtracting. We're talking, like, reshoots here. Like, so it's difficult to separate, you know, neatly what the differences are. But having seen both versions, though, are the changes in the director's cut enough that this film would be satisfying or achieves any kind of vision or statement on its subject matter at all?
The thing about it is this. I will say that the director's cut, it still ultimately fails, but it's at least failing on its own merits, and it's very much a work of, I mean, let's not forget, this is the first theatrical first full-length feature
film. And I think it may be the only Mark Christopher film that got wide release and studio backing.
Well, and that's it. I think he's only made shorts at the very fringes of the indie scene since. And that's, like I said, I mean, you can see there's a lot of talent that he has that he's bringing this film. But there are mistakes that, you know, dramatic mistakes, most of it involving issues like, let's talk about, again, Greg, who, again, coming to the climax of this movie where the whole relationship between the trio comes to a head, it doesn't really resolve in any meaningful way, because Greg ultimately just sort of forgives Shane and his wife with very little reason. And the final shot of them is after Shane's been tossed out of the club 50 or Studio 54, and he's wrapping himself in the plastic garbage bag trying to keep warm because he doesn't have a shirt in the middle of winter. You know, in the theatrical cut, you know, he's offered a ride by Neve Campbell's character in that, which, if I remember correctly, he does take her up on that. Does he not?
Because, okay. But then we have to explain who Julie is. Because, she's the actress. There's this weird interlude where he goes back to New Jersey for a little while, and they bump into each other in the same small town, and it may be the most, like, rage headache inducing 15 minutes I've watched for the show so far, because they bond over the fact that, sometimes it's nice to come back to small town New Jersey where we can really be ourselves again. And then over a cup of coffee, like, they basically fall in love right away, and he gives her some trinket or something so she'll always remember this day, ostensibly remembering meeting a vapid bartender who has no idea that he's being played by everyone around him. And then at New Year's Eve, though, they have a confrontation where she's about to sleep with a big-time producer to get an acting role. And he basically stands there and lectures her about integrity. And then after the club gets busted by the IRS, they're both outside. And he's like, what happened to the producer? And she's like, I guess I realized I wanted different things after all. It's like, let's keep in mind that the whole New Year's Eve sequence takes place in like maybe an hour and a half of story time. And this is when so many crazy events and climactic moments and everyone's character arc gets tied off neatly. It's mind-boggling.
Well, this is the thing, yeah. What happens is the interlude with the coffee stuff does happen in the theatrical version. The bowling scene with them does not, and is much better off without it. But what ends up happening is in that scene where she approaches him with the producer and offers that, his whole big speech that he gives her, not present whatsoever. In fact, it also turns out that the producer is somebody that Shane is showing going off to have sex with earlier on in the film. Hence why they so openly just start offering, it's like, hey, how would you like to come back with us for a private, meeting?
A party of three. Poor Nev Campbell, she's only used to party of five. Wait, was she on that show?
Yeah, and I...
Okay, she was thank on that God.
Yeah, but the thing that kills me about this is Nev Campbell throws me because she gets above the credit billing. She is, no matter
she's on which the version poster, of the, films, the quadrant of faces.
Yeah, and she only gets, like maybe in the theatrical cut, she gets maybe 10 minutes of screen time max, even less in the director's cut, because basically her role's reduced. She is literally only there as something that Shane is chasing. She is a dream that he's after, and comes to quickly realize, after that encounter with the producer, instead of lecturing her, he just basically decides to go see Billy and just get really, really high at that point.
As was the style at the time. But I will say, to Nev Campbell's credit, she's introduced and speaks in a Jersey accent and has the good sense to stop doing it immediately after that scene wraps. Did you notice that? Or is it just a trick of my ears?
Yeah. No, I know. It's a little detail, but the idea of, sort of code switching between... between aspects of the life.
But I don't think it's deliberate. Only because nothing in the film convinces me that the film is nuanced enough that it would actually think about, oh, yeah, and people also, like, jersey themselves up when they're back in the real world. Like, I can see a way that a film could do that. I mean, we were talking about Chimes at Midnight. It does the same thing with Prince Hal. I don't think that that's what Nev Campbell is doing here.
See, I disagree only because the film early on, in, no matter which cut you watch, sets it up with, Shane's first sexual encounter where he's told, we don't go with guys from Jersey. So I think there is a consciousness amongst, what Mark Christopher's going for about the idea of, where you're from and what you present as is certainly part and parcel of the film. Now, whether, Nev Campbell came up with that on her own or Christopher told her to do it, who can say? I will give them credit on that one. But the key thing, regardless, is, she gets top-of-the-line billing when, A, poor Breckenmeyer, who essentially gives two completely separate performances in two different movies, worked his butt off and can't get above the title billing whatsoever, despite being the main character.
Breckenmeyer is Greg in the film. He's very much like... he was always sort of around, like, the big teen movies of the early 2000s. Like, he was in Road Trip, and then he was in this, and then he was in Garfield. And it's just, I feel bad for him. But it's hard to say this without sounding critical for the wrong reasons. But let me put it to you this way. One of the early plot points and sort of one of the turns where Shane realizes that Steve may not be the nicest guy on earth is when he's trying to get his friends in the club, including one who's played by Mark Ruffalo. And yes. Steve asks him, he's like, well, your friends, do they look like you? And Shane, doesn't know how to respond. And Steve actually gives an interesting little passage where he says, like, I have the best and brightest of New York that wants to come here because this place has a reputation. I know a Saudi prince who flies here once a month simply so he can party and spend like $100,000 a night on bottle service. And he comes here because this is the place to be. So do your friends look like you? And, you know, it's a neat little speech, but the problem is, okay, Breckenmeyer, I like him. I think he's a capable actor. He's charming, but he does not have the conventional look of a Hollywood leading man. And that's not a fault against him. But in this film in particular, why would Greg have a job? You know, especially when in the film he's also self-critical about, oh, I'm too short and my nose is crooked and stuff. It begs the question, well, so Mark Ruffalo isn't good enough to get into the club, but it's like, but you keep Breckenmeyer on payroll? Like, I know that's not necessarily a plot hole in the script, just more a result of the casting, but that just struck me as very, very accidentally problematic, I guess, in terms of the logic of the film.
It yes and no. I think again, I could see a situation given the way in which Greg is treated by Rubel throughout the film, that this is again, that there's almost like this Job-esque thing where Greg is the guy that gets put upon by, you know, Rubel and others, and it's almost because Rubel gets a kick out of it. Like there is that, I mean, again, one of the early scenes in this film is, you know, Greg is the, you know, handing over the bundles of skimmed money to one of Rubel's cohorts, and then he gets drafted by Rubel to go back to his place to dump money on a bed where, you know, Mike Myers can deliver, you know, this drugged out, you know, series of statements. Some again, which I think very explicitly lay out what the film's kind of going
Yeah,
for,
that's probably
at
Steve
least.
at his most predatory. And to
Yeah.
Meyer's credit, though, I mean, I feel like that's a scene that could very easily spill into over-the-topness,
Yeah.
especially through the lens of, like, I'm an actor known for comedy, and this is supposed to be, like, my first role with teeth, you know? I can see it
Yeah.
very easily lapsing into parody. Myers actually restrains himself pretty well in that scene, and so it
Yeah.
goes from being like sort of silly, like party drunk mode, and just like everything's loose, and then it gets a bit more focused and intense and like anxiety inducing. And like the scene imparts this sense of almost like claustrophobia. And then like at the end, he basically spits up on himself and he's like, oh, never mind, just kidding. And I mean,
Well, and
the
that's the thing.
movement there, I think that's probably the most effective scene in the cut that I watched. But yeah, you know, but again, that leads further credence to the idea that Steve is not a good person. But we don't even feel sympathy for Greg because in the theatrical cut, yeah, he's swiping from the till and he's selling drugs out the back door. So how much sympathy do we really feel for his plight?
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I mean, the film, the theatrical cut is such an unfocused, you know, set of contradictions that it really, I mean, I will say this. Both versions of this film I find watchable. I think the theatrical version is an outright failure, but at least as you're watching, it's like, huh, that's a thing that exists, and you can see the hint of good ideas. And likewise, the director's cut, it's like, okay, I see much clearer what you're going for and what you're trying to do. You don't achieve it, at least the way you're kind of aiming to do it. But, you know, kudos to everyone involved for doing their best to try and make this work and find a way to get to it. And yeah, no, I can completely understand, you know, I think in the context of the director's cut, yeah, Steve Rubell is openly a monster. Throughout it. And again, you know, we should note that Steve Rubell was one of the few real life individuals that is explicitly named in this film here. And again, he died in 1989, so I think it's kind of, again, I think part and parcel why he's named here is because legally he's probably the safest to sort of deal with because he's not there to sort of defend himself in any way, shape, or form. But I again, you know, it's like there are moments and aspects of this film I really like. And I think one of the things, again, something we haven't touched upon in this film is, and again, it's going to bring us right back to the climactic New Year's Eve sequence, which I know you're not fond of, Andrew. But Ellen Albertini Dow as Disco Dottie / Mona.
AKA rapping grandma again, from The Wedding Singer, right?
Yes, but she, again, Disco Dottie is based off of a real individual, which is Disco Sally, an individual who, following in real life, after her husband's death, a friend, you know, basically said, let's go take a look at this club. And Rubel let them in, just kind of amused at the notion that, oh, here are these two little old ladies who come there, and pretty much promised Sally to be able to come to every night. And yeah, almost every night she went there. And Disco Down and became sort of a fixture of the scene and noteworthy in her own right. Dottie is very loosely based on her, and I think a lot of her stuff actually works. And there's this, basically the crux of the climax of this film revolves around Disco Dottie getting too high and dying of a heart attack on the dance floor during Anita's
big performance. But that's where the film misses the trick, because I think I would agree that of all the people in the film, Dottie is probably the most interesting, only because here you have an elderly woman who we're not given much by way of backstory, other than knowing that she's a grandma and she goes to the same pharmacy as Shane. But like I figured that she was just going to be played for gags, but like I can see very easily, like, tell a film that involves her a bit more, and then you can see why Studio 54 is so important, why it allows people to step outside of themselves or step into their real selves and feel that sense of liberation there. Whereas we don't get that sense of liberation from the other characters. We get, you know, a very brief bit of Shane thinking, hey, it's pretty cool when you can hang out with celebrities you don't recognize and sleep with a few of them. But then for everybody else, it's just a grind and misery and humiliation. Dottie seems to enjoy it, you know? There's a reason that she's a mainstay. But then it just ends in the most, like, as you said, after-school special way imaginable, where, yeah, they're doing the crowd salutation on New Year's Eve, and she just happens to die right then and there as they're counting down. It's like... It's just, at that point, it becomes way, way too much of a Hollywood movie, where, of course, the one symbol of goodness in this whole place is going to overdose and die right now.
And you're not wrong. I will say this, you're right, it's an obvious trick, it's an obvious thing that happened, and certainly isn't based on any sort of truth.
But it's just so facile. You know, it's insulting in how oversimplified and just stock it comes off as.
Well, and that's the thing. I think part of the problem is, there's a couple problems at play here. Is, again, I think part of it is that Mark Christopher doesn't hit the mark, even in his director's cut of this film. The thing is, he doesn't really have the arc that Shane undergoes is still kind of unclear. But like when you get to the end of it, you know, it's not like, I mean, I will say this about the theatrical cut. In the case of the theatrical cut, his transformation by the end of it, as ridiculous and after-school special as it is, okay, you at least see how
he's
changed.
What does he transform into, Dave? What's his reward for this beautiful journey of self-discovery?
He apparently is successful at something after attending college, having done
He becomes something. A restaurant manager.
Yeah, which is like, which is hilarious, because again, in the director's cut version, his father does point out to him, it's like, you could go to college, and he points, it's like, but I flunked so much of high school. And it's just like, yeah, he's not bright. And again, you know, that's one of these things that's, you know, it's a farce, it's the thing, but at least there's a clarity of where he ends up. And you don't quite get that in the director's cut, where basically the final shot of the film is Greg, Anita, and Shane all together wrapped in a fur coat together walking away from Studio 54 after they've all left it. And presumably from what's indicated, Anita went and had herself photographed beside Disco Dottie's dead body. Again, there's a very clear set of mixed messages going on here that I don't think Mark Christopher intended.
Well, it's better than the theatrical cut with the everything's okay narration, and it ends with everybody looking up admiringly at Steve Rubel as the lights go down, and it's just his silhouette standing up in the rafters, like, still looking down, as if it's like, hey, we really should be sad now that he's dead.
But that's the thing, I think, that coming back to one of the things I mentioned towards the start of the show, which was the fact that, you know, this is basically Hollywood mythmaking about Hollywood here. And part of the problem in the theatrical cut is that Steve Rubell is effectively the producer figure in this thing. He is the person who's masterminding and organizing everything and making sure everybody has a good time. And it very much feels like one of the reasons that this movie can't, in the theatrical cut, come hard down on Steve Rubell and tries in some way to make him a figure of at least pity or sympathy or somebody to feel sorry for, is the notion that, you know, he is Hollywood in many ways. I mean, this is the guy who was connected to everybody, who did entertain everyone. And it's not, and again, it's not a shock that, you know, as soon as we hit the credits in the theatrical version, again, what are we shown? It's not, you know, Studio 54, the scumbag club that in which people could be preyed upon because they were desperate to have some place that they could be themselves. It is, you know, hey, Sly Stallone showing up. Hey, is maybe that Bowie? I mean, who?
Yeah, look, it's Truman Capote. For those of you in the crowd who read, you know, it ties it off by reminding us, well, in spite of everything, it was still a pretty cool place to be.
Well, and that's the thing. I feel part of the reason that this film almost can't be produced by Hollywood, at least in Hollywood as it was then, and probably still not even today, is the fact that it would require to be able to lacerate itself in a way that a film with this kind of money and this kind of budget and this kind of distribution would never get.
Let me ask you this. Could never have. Did you ever see the documentary The Kid Stays in the Picture?
I have not, mostly because I think Robert Evans is human.
Well, you are correct. But the thing is, that's a film. It's a documentary about superstar producer Bob Evans, who is a lot like Steve Rubell in this film. But the difference is, it's being made, at least with a much greater degree of independence. And it also knows how to be critical of its subject. Honestly, the easiest way they accomplish that is just have Robert Evans talk and show footage of the things he's referring to. And, like, he establishes himself as an unreliable narrator, and the film doesn't shy away from that. Instead, you're right, Dave, like, within Hollywood, like, I'm sure some of the people involved with funding this film probably went to 54 themselves, and the result is, it's like a hagiography, in a sense, where it's like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, Steve Rubell was a deeply flawed man, but think about all the good stuff he did. He gave people paychecks and ran a nightclub for a couple years. And, like, again, I think you may be exactly right, where it's Hollywood doesn't understand how to be critical of itself, and it doesn't understand how to be critical of those, like, within its immediate sphere of influence. And I think that's really prevents this film from taking shape as anything.
Well, no, and you're not wrong. And that's, it is ultimately, this film seems to be the intersection of contradictory and competing ideas and concepts and issues that it really can't cohesively put together in a way that is, you know, decisive and critical in a way that it wants to be. And it's frustrating because I do think that there is probably a great film to be made about Steve Rubell and Studio 54. I also think that that film has to be made about as far removed from the studio system as possible. But once you get to that point, guess what? You probably can't afford to do anything, let alone amount probably the necessary legal barriers to prevent yourself from getting sued silly in the process of it. And that's just exceptionally frustrating. And again, looking at it in light of, again, what's happened with the Weinsteins, where I'm sure Harvey Weinstein looks at himself, you know, as being like Steve Rubell and sees themselves as both sort of picked upon.
Well, in the recent interview, how he defended himself saying, I didn't do anything that nobody else in Hollywood wasn't doing already. And it's like, you know, and in that sense, I see why certain people would have an affinity for Steve Rubell, because it's like, well, everybody was doing it at the time. That's not the same thing as it being okay or it being acceptable. And yeah, it's just, how the film can present what it presents and still refuse to take a firm stance, or even worse, to just brush it all away and say, well, he meant well. You know, that is why I think probably I'm a lot more irritated than you because I don't have the director's cut as a point of contrast. You know, not that it sounds like his treatment is any more nuanced or critical in the director's cut, but just, like,
At least, no, sorry, didn't mean to cut you off there.
like, what I'm left with wondering, Dave, especially when you and I, when we were early teenagers, this film was everywhere. It was marketed everywhere. But let me ask you this. Who is this film for? Because based on the theatrical cut, I mean, they excise all the queerness out of it. So, I mean, it's not reaching out to young kids who feel like they don't fit in. And, you know, it's not a it gets better narrative. It's not a coming out story. But it's also way too simplistic in the theatrical cut, especially with the most patronizing, everything turned out good for everyone, because we're good people, final coda to the film. It's too out there for Hollywood because they want to address things like the downside of the party circuit or characters that may not be 100% heterosexual. Nobody in who's a fan of new queer cinema as a movement would be interested in this because it's all run through the lens of Hollywood aesthetics. Like, who is this film meant to be for?
And the answer is ultimately, at least as far as the theatrical cut goes, nobody, ultimately. Like, I mean, it is a film that will satisfy
So,
nobody and no
who's the
audience because
director's
it
cut
is
for
just.
then, other than Mark Christopher?
Well, and that's the thing. And I would at least say, you know, it's the thing with the director's cut is it's my enjoyment coming is from almost an academic perspective. It is. The analysis that goes into seeing, okay, and that's the thing. This is a film that's almost more, a more interesting for where it fails than what it succeeds
But
at doing,
failure is only
ultimately. And I want
interesting
more.
if it fails in the service of something, or if there's something that we can learn from those failures. And do we really need to sit through the 2 hour 20 minute director's cut of this that was an ultra rare bootleg for all this time, when the only thing we're really learning is, wow, Hollywood in the 90s had no idea how to work with independent directors, and it had no idea how to tell stories that involve queerness? Like, isn't that something we knew already?
I would say it's something, okay, in the general sense, yeah, it is something we knew already. I would say getting into the nuts and bolts of it, and, you know, again, because of the way in which this film was positioned, because of where it exists, I mean, this was a high profile project, and I think it is interesting in the broader cultural context to take a look at it and see, okay, this was part and parcel of the conversation going at the time. This is what was going on. And here is a prime example of where things went down and where things failed. And I think there is something about the notion of seeing a queer filmmaker such as Mark Christopher, you know, getting invited into the studio system and then taking apart ultimately how he doesn't know, you know, how it ultimately, you know, screws him over, for lack of a better, you know, phrasing here. And I think, yeah, no, I mean, does that make this a good movie? No, and I won't argue for it being a good movie. I gave the director's cut a 2.5 stars, which I admit is being probably generous when doing that. But,
What would you
I
give the
mean, it's
theatrical?
still. I gave it 2 stars. I would probably say, again, that's being generous. Probably 1.5 stars at most would probably be out of 5 would be what I would give it. But again, I think there is something interesting there. And I'm certainly, you know, again, it's not going to go down as one of the important films. But I also would say, yeah, failures like this are worth considering and looking at because they make up part of the chain of history and cultural dialogue that does go on there. But.
Okay, that's valid, I guess. But I guess I mean, if you want to look at new queer cinema, especially, like, there are other directors, even Gus Van Sant, who's come up a few times in this conversation. Like, he has texts that were independently produced, did involve queer themes, and yet, 20 years later, he also ends up bringing Sean Penn an Oscar for making the film Milk, you know? So that might be an example of learning to work within and be incorporated within that. I think it's also interesting that, like, when Gus Van Sant becomes, like, mainstream popular, it's for movies like Good Will Hunting that, again, really, really excise queerness from the narrative completely. And it's like he has to build up a certain amount of Hollywood-only cachet before he can make the films that he really wants to. Like, I guess the way I would see it is that there are other films that probably have to go through the same kinds of compromises and the same sort of studio interference, but even then, in their manipulated final forms and that, I feel like they have got to be better than the theatrical cut of 54. It's just like from an analytic perspective, you're right. There's a lot of interesting things going on in terms of history, in terms of where the industry and society was at the time, in terms of how all these people were positioned to be breakout stars, and it kind of happened for some of them, but it is not at all an interesting film to watch. And first and foremost, we are film viewers. And the only joy to be had in this film then is by putting it under a microscope and pulling it apart.
And you're not wrong, and I will fully cop to that. And that's the thing. I mean, ultimately, it really depends upon what you're going in to get out of this, because I am somebody, and I will fully admit, I will watch bad movies just to put them under a microscope and take them apart because they fascinate me. Like I find failures fascinating and worth discussing and worth bisecting like that. And that's not going to be for everybody. And I fully acknowledge that that's the case going forward. I mean, I guess if you're inclined to be like myself, I would say that 54 is worth seeking out and taking a look at in those regards. If you're purely looking for either an entertaining experience or certainly, wanting to see a quote unquote good film, yeah, don't watch this one because you're not going to get it
That should be the pull quote
ultimately
on
at
the
the end of the
director's
day.
cut re-release, where it's, 2.5 stars. Wow, don't watch this film, Dave Babbitt. That's probably going to be the nicest pull quote you can find as well. Just, what do you do with a film like this? It's a mess, Dave. And the way that, like, in one sense, it's like, what did they expect? Like, I don't put blame on Mark Christopher here because, again, there's the familiar trope of the indie director in way over his head and not prepared to deal with the reality of studios. But the studio itself, when you're picking up an indie director and one associated with queer cinema, and like y they knew exactly what they were getting, and they put him in a position where he couldn't deliver anything that would have been workable. And the result is you have two different versions that, even though they are radically different, they neither of them ever seems to be fully coherent or fully works as a movie. And it's like, in some respects, it's like, well, that's kind of the lesson that execs had to learn, where it wasn't just a matter of, okay, well, we'll take some guy that we read about in the trades, we flew him out to Hollywood, and we had to make a movie our way. Like, there's more to creators than just putting them in a different city and on a different lot and telling them to go nuts and do what they did before. And I think, if anything, 54 really, really emphasizes that indie is not just a look. It's not just a sensibility. It is, first and foremost, a means of production. And, the same thing happened in music, where all of a sudden we had, quote unquote, indie bands being released on Universal Records and that. And it's like, oh, so really all you meant was you enjoy bands that sound kind of twee, right? And, and the whole idea that, oh, well, the singer's wearing a flannel button up, so it's got to be indie. The moment you take an independent filmmaker and put them in a studio, they are no longer an independent filmmaker. You can't have that once you take it away. And it's something that still happens in this day and age. So the industry didn't really learn anything from the failure of 54 either.
No, and I mean, let's be honest. I mean, Hollywood is not known for its capacity for to learn lessons from anything its mistakes.
Well, clearly neither
This is
am
how we end
I,
up with
because
things.
I gave you Superman and you gave me this.
I would love to see what the exact, tally of what's quote unquote films that you've enjoyed that I've actually picked versus films that you've picked that I've enjoyed has well, been see, so far.
Even the failures have been fascinating, except for this one.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that this one remains fascinating, but again, this is going to be up to the individual viewer in this instance, and certainly your tastes will vary. But I think we sort of reached the end of our general impressions and that on this film. So I guess maybe getting into the hits and pits would make a bit of sense. What do you say?
I think so, especially because my sinus medication is starting to wear off. That or this film just has that effect on me. So, Dave, you picked it. You take responsibility. What are the hits of this film that we haven't talked about?
In terms of hits here, I would probably sit there and say I'm going to give credit for the soundtrack, the song selection on this film, which, for the most part, kudos to them for not choosing all the obvious disco hits to toss on this thing, because I was afraid it was just going to be like a greatest hits sampler. But no, you actually get some, you know, deeper cuts on this thing, which, you know, does suggest a bit more of the period qualities than would otherwise be suggested. I mean, we get things such as Dan Hartman's Vertigo Relight My Fire, which, not a radio staple by any
stretch. But an awesome song.
That's an absolutely awesome song. The Boss by Diana Ross. I mean, not the first film that would come to mind when you're doing this sort of thing. But yeah, no, it works. So, I mean, again, kudos to them for that kind of, you know, deep digging.
But let me counter that, Dave, because I agree the soundtrack is mostly there. But what does it tell you when this is a film that's meant to be a period piece about New York in the 1970s, and the song that the film is built around is a contemporary disco-based cover of a song by Gordon Lightfoot?
I was going to get there in a little bit, but yes, I will say, let's just list that as a pit right now.
Because well, I think it's emblematic, though.
If You Could Read My Mind by Gordon Lightfoot.
Because, yeah, Stars on 54 performed it, but they were a band created for this movie so they could make this song that's a different style cover of a Gordon Lightfoot song. And this film's problem with authenticity and inauthenticity, I think, can be summed up in that statement.
It could be. My thing is, you know what? Okay, it's an oddball choice. And yeah, this sort of blending, because it's not the only song. I believe Santa Esmeralda does a cover of Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which we referenced at the top of the show here. And I am reasonably sure not a disco artist whatsoever. But again, my issue isn't so much the inclusion of the covers in this film of the songs, because it's like, okay, fine, you know what, it was probably cheaper to do this. What throws me is the repeated use of the of that sort of guitar riff from If You Could Read My Mind at various points. That borders on parodic in terms of its placement, and is so distracting where it's like, okay, are you going to start kicking in the song now? Because I really want to start hearing it, or I'm very tempted to start singing along over your dialogue. I mean, like, seriously, I get it. I see what you're trying to do, but it's distracting and it's not working.
Well, not every leitmotif can be Otis's theme.
But yeah, so yeah, no, it's a problem. I will grant you that. But taking on the own, the cover's not bad.
I mean, it's ridiculous from a conceptual standpoint, but the cover itself, yes, it's catchy.
Okay, Andrew, so with that, what's your, you got a hit, a pit? I'm guessing pits, but
they're mostly pits. I think the biggest pit is that by teasing us with the cover of If You Can Read My Mind, it just made me really long for a disco cover of Canadian Railroad Trilogy. No, I think my other, my next pit is also a musical one. I feel bad for Selma Hayek because we haven't mentioned her at all because we're so furious about the rest of this movie. I think her performance is decent. She doesn't have a lot to do, but Anita's whole thing is that she's a singer and that she, you know, is really working on her craft. And based off the two songs that she sings here, Anita is a terrible singer. She was never going to make it. But yet in the Happy Coda, it's also, oh, yeah, and Anita ended up putting out a record. It's like, so everything worked out okay for everyone, regardless of anything they did or whether or not it was deserved or not. I don't know. I think that again, is one of those moments where there's such a disparity between what the film is telling us versus what the film is showing us that it just causes cognitive dissonance.
But not wrong, and I was actually spending a good chunk of the film trying to decide whether her inability to perform was a choice or whether that was just Selma Hayek's inability to sing, and I really couldn't tell. I'm still not sure.
Oh, so you have benefit of the doubt for Neve Campbell's Jersey accent, but not for Selma Hayek.
All right, fine. I will give Selma Hayek the benefit of the doubt. That is fair. That is very fair. But go on.
Yeah, let's see. No, let's balance out some negativity. We never go to bed angry. Dave, do you have a hit to point out?
Let's put it to, like this, because I know this is something you're going to disagree with me about. I don't think Ryan Phillippe's that bad. I really don't. Like, part of it is he's basically doing an even dimmer version of John Travolta's 70s persona. There, like, where he just seems kind of oblivious and in over his head. And, of course, it's punctuated in the director's cut by the fact that he actually does a repeatedly terrible Travolta impersonation, because as he keeps trying to pitch himself, it's like, oh yeah, and I also do impersonations, which is, again, I get what they're going for thematically, and the fact that here's somebody who's presenting themselves as an impersonator, but you could see through, like, without any doubt or question at any given moment that as to how terrible or as to how out of place he is. But yeah, no, I think Phillippe does capture that. And I also give credit to, while the voiceover narration is eliminated for the most part in the director's cut, there is a small snippet right at the very beginning, except it was re-recorded by Ryan Phillippe now. And I don't know whether to credit him simply as an actor or the fact that, you know, there was about 17 years of time for his voice to change. But it definitely has a gruffer vibe to it that gives it more of a sense of memory.
Looking back upon, yeah.
Yeah. So, again, kudos there for that one. But,
well, I mean, talking to you before the show, a few things were a bit less infuriating. Because, you know, I've only seen the original cut. And the issue is that with the editing and the fact that there are all these missing or truncated scenes and that, like, it's impossible to like Shane. And yeah. But the film never really develops the film's own presentation of him as a self-reflexively critical thing. I mean, there's the dinner party scene where he's called a troglodyte, but otherwise, like, you know, the part that I ended up messaging you directly about was how at one and the same time, like, the film shows everybody's just doing what they can to hustle to get to a better life, while at the same time Shane's talking about how he's hobnobbing with celebs, giving magazine interviews. He has a pretty nice Pontiac, you know, Sportster with a vanity license plate, and it's like, at the same time, he needs to count on some old woman's charity so he can buy penicillin to deal with his VD. You know, it's, the film can't make up its mind about him. But, like, the issue is that if that's what the film is trying to do, like, invite the criticism of Shane as a character, like, he doesn't really learn anything in the theatrical cut. And at the end, it's just, oh, well, he ends up getting a good job, because I noticed the ending narration describes everything as good. Simply yeah. Good. You know, Neve Campbell, Julie, she ends up getting a part in a good movie. Greg, he ends up getting a good job during construction. And it's so, like, pat you on the head and tuck you in. But, you know, it's like there's no teeth to the criticism. But even if there was, then we basically have the film Midnight Cowboy. And I feel like that's bound to do what 54 is doing better than 54 is doing it. Because Joe Buck, he's the guy who comes to the big city is in way over his head and just gets duped and used by everybody else around him, and he's too dumb to know any better. And the film ends with him finally on his own, realizing he has no idea what to do. This film tries to tell a similar story, but it ends with everybody learning a big lesson, and it works out good for everyone.
Yeah, you're not wrong. Thank God that ending sort of coda was cut from the director's cut. It is just an abomination.
Well, my blood pressure would be lower for sure. Yeah. But I may surprise you, Dave, because I do have a hit for this film.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
And I did not expect I would have it for this person, because normally I don't really like this person. I will say that even though it's kind of telegraphed as stepping out of your comfort zone and playing against type, Mike Myers isn't bad in this movie. And it's not a great performance. And again, it doesn't get around the fact that the film has no idea what it even thinks about Steve Rubell. But I think Mike Myers plays the character well enough that he's as charming as he needs to be for it to be plausible that people gravitate around him, and also scary and dangerous just enough that we see, you know, the hints of the downside of 70s nightlife and things like that. Like, it never comes off as over the top, and it never comes off as too self-conscious or, you know, parodic of what a quote-unquote real actor would do. It's not the best performance I've ever seen, but it's probably the best one in the movie.
No, easily. And I really, again, I'm completely with you. I think Myers does really great work. And Myers is one of those people where I enjoy him. I'm always convinced there's something slightly off about him. Like, any time I watch him, he always seems like there's something kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah, like when him and Kanye did that telethon.
Well, even beyond that one. But I mean, you know, Myers has always struck me as somebody who doesn't seem really comfortable in his own skin. And
that's probably why he wears fat suits so often.
Well, but I mean, I think...
You just keep softballing me, Dave.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, really, you look at films like this, I think he does interesting work. And I think there is something... Myers is actually one of those actors who I honestly feel might be better suited to these kinds of peculiar character parts than they are necessarily as headlining films. Because I think Myers, one of his big troubles has been he's always sort of tried to be a bit more Peter Sellers-esque. And the thing is, he's not skilled enough to pull that off. But there is a range of roles which do have kind of a seedier side that I think he's actually quite suited for. And certainly he pulls it off here. I mean, we'll see him... I forget who he's playing in the Bohemian Rhapsody film, the Queen biopic that's coming up, but we'll see how his dramatic chops turn out there as well. But
I'm pretty sure he's just going to be cast as Wayne Campbell.
Could be, but I mean, that's going to be a heck of a lot of motion capture to do child Wayne Campbell. at any rate, but yeah, so there, yeah, Myers, credit where credit's due. But to give a moment of... Pitt here that we haven't mentioned, and again, mercifully not in the director's cut, but unfortunately is in the theatrical version. Anita's disco dancing lesson to Suburban People.
Yeah, that struck me as so odd because it's just thrown in there, and it's like, so wait, you're a dance instructor at the club? You're teaching other people who work there how to dance? Are you just offering courses for people in case they go to 54? It just cuts away, and she's leading a class.
Oh, it is so clearly a studio-mandated scene, because it's basically there for her and Shane to further flirt and, quote-unquote, have chemistry. And see, there are suburban people in this movie. It's not all these weird, freaky New Yorkers folks here. You're in this world, too. No, you're not. This is not that film. But it is just a painful scene to sit there and watch, because Anita is the coat check girl at 54. That's her, you know, who position at the club, and part of it is that she wants to be a major, you know, singer. She wants to be a star herself. She puts all her time and energy into that. Why is suddenly she having this thing where I'm going to teach old folks and kids to dance? Like, where does this come from in this character? Is she paid to do this? Is there something she gains out of it? Not to mention, if this is actually teaching people how to disco dance. For the record, nobody we actually see on the dance floor at 54 is dancing like this. It's like
really... Or much at all, really. They're just grabbing other people and eating with their nostrils.
Or doing coke. Lots and lots of coke. But it's...
Trying to be subtle there. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, well, I mean, but it's the thing. Like, I mean, it's hard to believe that this person who... you know, is teaching these kids and, you know, old people how to dance is also the same person who says, I want to meet this producer. Could you mind giving her this small vial of cocaine? She's really into it, please. I mean, it's just the dissonance there is shocking.
Well, yeah, it's a very, it's a paltry attempt to humanize these characters because God knows they all need some help, like coming off as relatable or likable. But I mean, like, that would be the equivalent of, you know, shows Greg selling drugs in the club, but then there's a cutaway to him passed out from donating blood too many times at the local hospital. Or, you know, Shane Parks's Pontiac Firebird hops out and then walks in and volunteers in a soup kitchen. You know, Steve is flirting with all the employees and that shows him reading at the local library. It's just, yeah, it, ugh.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible, terrible choice.
This film is breaking me, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah, but you keep saying most of the films I've chosen have broken you. I believe we go right back to that with Where the Buffalo Roam. So. But I
okay. Well, all right. I mean, yeah, I think I'm officially done. 54 may actually be our longest episode, and it is the least deserving of it. I think I'm out of pits, and I gave it the one positive I could. Do you have anything else that we haven't covered?
Not of any significant value, so we should probably just wrap this on up and say, yeah, side with Andrew, side with me. Either way, it's not a great movie, but...
Well, I mean, the issues that Hollywood has, again, with quote-unquote indie or non-mainstream filmmakers, they still remain, you know, and certainly Hollywood still has problems with queerness. And this is one of those moments where it just marks the studio had their chance to do that, and then they got cold feet based on some test screenings, and they basically scuttled the whole project and decided it would be better to mandate a film that could not have worked, nor could it have made any sense. And that's the result. What you're seeing on screen is Hollywood thinking that modern film-going audiences are fundamentally much more conservative than they probably are. So, you know, even when we see, like, ridiculously pedantic films where, you know, two gay side characters end up falling in love because they're the only gay characters in the film, just remember, that's not as bad as it can get.
Yeah.
At least they don't erase identities in those. So, yeah, if you want to hear how funky Gordon Lightfoot can sound, and if you want to see Mike Myers do something other than a Scottish accent, you know, you can come here and revisit that glorious halcyon summer of 1998. Boy, Dave, were we ever so young, everything seemed so possible.
Yeah. But having said that, I guess my time at the wheel is over with. I'm sure the gun that you're pointing at me to get away from it is indicative of that. So
well, that means I can take this hose away and roll down the window. Yeah, so I am going to keep with my tradition of picking movies that are good to watch, or at least going to be a bit more fun than this one. So I am going to follow the character played by Michael York in this film. He plays the ambassador who's in it for two scenes and vanishes. Yeah. Sense a pattern happening here. But we are going to follow him all the way back to a film that he starred in from 1970. This is why you write things down. A little film called Logan's Run, which I will freely admit, I haven't seen. I've only seen it referenced. And based off what I know of the plot, it sounds like it's going to be absolutely bonkers, even if it's not very good. So, well, Dave, do you think that'll be a nice palate cleanser?
Well, for the 20th episode anniversary of the show, yeah, it absolutely will. We get some real 1970s, a swinging, well, not swinging, but an interesting Jerry Goldsmith score. Yeah, I'm totally down with this. So, so you can stay tuned for that for next week. But until then, Andrew, where can people find you if they want to, you know, add to the commentary on this film or just reveal that themselves as like, yeah, no, we were Disco Dottie fans and curse your, you know, refusal to acknowledge the tragedy of her death.
Yeah, it's Teach the Conspiracy. Disco Dottie lives on. You can find me on Twitter at Filmstripper. And what about you, Dave?
I'm at 24 panels. Note, I'm pro Disco Dottie. So, turn all your criticism over to Andrew.
Feel free to shout us out there. Actually, it's been a couple good weeks in a row in terms of people reaching out. I don't know how anybody finds us, but we've had some interesting talks with some interesting people. And, it's always interesting to hear what you think of two Laurier boys arguing late at night about films no one even remembers. Otherwise, I still have that domain, filmstrippod.wordpress.com, and I promise one of these days I'll actually have more than a default layout on there. As I know more, so will you. And Dave, if people want to, say, rate or review our show, where would they go to do that?
Well, we have this little place called iTunes. They've given us a little bit of space to show up in that. And by giving us, I mean we pay Podomatic in order to help us get on there. But still, beyond that, yes, you can rate and review us there. 5 stars, please. Any sort of additional, 5-star reviews helps us get noticed, helps builds up our listenership. Please spread the word about the show as well. If you happen to have your own Twitter handles or, use things like Facebook. I'm sure Russian agents really want to listen to us.
We're the last bastion of freedom right here because they'll be too busy arguing over 54 to ever mind with a successful coup. But 5-star reviews are the best way to get additional attention on the show. But honestly, honesty is important. If I learn one thing from Shane O'Shea, it's that integrity is what matters. So even if you're leaving us 0.5 star, hey, just leave it. We can't get any better if no one tells us what we're doing wrong.
Precisely. So until then, any parting words, Andrew?
Yes. Remember, dear travelers, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you. Unless dance floor cocaine does it first.
Bye.